Hey everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic, presented by BetMGM. I am Max Boltman. With me as always is Prashant Iyer, and we can finally exhale after a frantic few days around the Red Wings at the trade deadline, a busy weekend of trades, and then the Monday shocker, the Anthony Mantha trade to the Washington Capitals. The Red Wings actually, during that span, sweep the Carolina Hurricanes, which I don't think anybody saw coming. From 10,000 feet now, reflecting on the last 5 days, Prashant, what stands out to you, both on the ice and in the front office?
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly a whirlwind of 5 days to, number one, get punched in the mouth on Saturday by Carolina right out the gate, fight back, and then get a 5-4 shootout win. Then Monday, you trade arguably your most talented forward, arguably your best defenseman on the season in John Merrill, and then you come back the following day and absolutely shut down the Hurricanes. Once again, a team that was the number one team in the league by points percentage. So I think the big thing I learned off ice is I learned a lot about Steve Yzerman in terms of he is still willing to swing and swing real big when he feels like he needs to in order to get that shakeup going. And I think we'll get into it a little bit later, but I think we learned a lot about where Yzerman sees this rebuild at, how much longer he thinks he has to go on it. And kind of what he felt Anthony Mantha's role could potentially be on this team when they were competitive. And then on the ice, you learn that this team, no matter what anyone says about them, no matter where they're at in the standings, they continue to fight and they continue to play hard and they continue to somehow absolutely flummox the Carolina Hurricanes, as they are now 4-3-1 against the Carolina Hurricanes on the season, the best team in the league.
4-2-1.
4-2-1. Still got a game left. That's right. Yeah. That's right. One more game to go. 4-2-1. Against the best team in the league right now. So I don't know where it's coming from, but they are certainly showing that fight and heart. And so, you know, just the sidebar I have to give is whenever people are like, oh, the team has quit on Jeff Blashill, no, they have not. You continue to see them fight and fight hard in games like that.
That one was the most surprising to me, because at past years, we have seen the Red Wings make a big trade. Gustav Nyquist comes to mind. Andreas Athanasiou comes to mind.
Thomas Tatar
comes to mind. I don't remember what happened after the 18 deadline, but those last two deadlines, they've been really bad for at least a few games afterwards. And I've always chalked that up to upheaval in the locker room. How do you process that? How do you compartmentalize the emotions of, you know, I don't want to say losing a friend. Everybody's still alive. Everybody's still friends. It's fine. But having that big change in terms of the person sitting next to you, maybe, or the person that you always are used to talking to before or after the game, and the emotional impact, I think, of that is immediate. The NHL doesn't stop. And I thought, when I saw that Anthony Mantha had been traded, you couple it with how banged up they already have been, I thought the Hurricanes were going to run over the Red Wings on Monday night. You know, not just because Mantha was out of the lineup, but because of kind of the, we were certainly shocked. I have to imagine that they were surprised as well. And it was not like that at all. I mean, the resolve was as, I don't know that Carolina played a great game, I'll say that. But for the Red Wings to weather the storm that they did that day off the ice and then come back and hang tough with what I think is one of the five best teams in the NHL, I thought was really impressive.
Yeah. I mean, you saw the kind of heartfelt emotion from Dylan Larkin, obviously losing Mantha, who had been there basically his entire career with Larkin. The two of them kind of played together, I think, for the better part of the last 6 or 7 years. And, you know, not only did you now take Anthony Mantha out of the lineup, you took John Merrill out of the lineup, you had Patrick Nemeth out of the lineup. You still didn't have Robbie Fabry. You still don't have Tyler Bertuzzi. That was absolutely a game ripe for Detroit to get a 9-1 loss hung on them, and it didn't happen. They came out and they absolutely smothered the Hurricanes. You look at how well they played the Hurricanes. I mean, just across the board, not only at 5-on-5, the Hurricanes power play is the best power play in hockey. I mean, they were basically at 30% for majority of the season. And I think in the game on Saturday, they got exactly 0 shots on goal in 2 chances. And Tuesday, they weren't really, or sorry, Monday, they weren't even really that much closer to generating anything there. So I really thought the Wings just came out and did a fantastic job rallying around, you know, the guys that were in the locker room and finding a way to come out with a couple victories.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I wanted to talk about was the, you know, you talked about Yzerman will do anything. And I think that is a really important topic for us today. And we'll get into all the different tentacles that conversation has, I guess, in a minute here. You know, it wasn't like there hadn't been any speculation around Anthony Mantha. And in fact, on the first Athletic trade board, Craig Custance, I think, was the first one to kind of lob it out there that Yzerman was listening on all his young forwards. I'll say when I brought that up to people, the response I was mostly met with was that that's unlikely. And you know, those kind of deals happen in the off season at the draft, when every team's kind of in again. Especially this year, the limits on how large the buyer's market is, the limits on the incentives for buying, although I do think it's different for rentals and non-rentals. But even this was probably the worst year to be trying to trade a player with term because of the expansion draft considerations. And so that was the reason that it was mostly the shock to me. Not because I thought that, you know, it was a lock that Anthony Mantha would be a Red Wing forever, but just because this year seemed like a really hard environment to try and pull off a deal like this. And I have to say, you know, I'm not one of the people who thinks that Washington got fleeced here. I think that there's a real case for this deal for both sides. And I think you really saw the Washington side of that case evidenced in how darn good Anthony Mantha looked in his debut with the Capitals Tuesday night. But I have to say, I was both surprised and impressed with the way that Yzerman was able to maneuver this under the constraints of this particular deadline, all things considered.
Yeah, I think if you're looking for what the number one takeaway from this deadline was, it was that cap space was a premium and teams were paying exorbitant prices just to get, you know, a couple million dollars shaved off on some of these contracts. So I'm with you, Max. I certainly didn't see Yzerman being able to move a $5.7 million average annual value contract that has a few more years left with no retention whatsoever. Now, yes, the Richard Panik inclusion is sort of that retention, if you will, as he signed all the way through 2023. And at $2.75 million, so you can maybe think, okay, they basically paid to get out of $2.75 million of that Mantha deal there. But that being said, I still didn't see a contract like this being moved. And if you look kind of across the board, there were no contracts like this moved unless you had that third team kicked in to really absorb the price, as Detroit served for David Savard to take on 50% or really ultimately 25% of his contract. And as you saw, you know, other teams do in the Nick Foligno deal, I think you saw San Jose be able to step in and do that there. So I just certainly didn't see Mantha being able to move right now. And then the other flip side to it is usually the prices paid at the deadline usually pale in comparison to what you're able to get around the draft or in the summer. Now, granted, Mantha was not a rental. He is under contract for a handful more years, which maybe allowed the price to stay up. But this was certainly not something I saw coming.
No, and I think that's why we were shocked, and it was certainly a scramble on Monday to put the pieces of this deal together. We're going to come back to that and give kind of a 2 days later assessment on that in a moment, but let's rewind a few days first and kind of unpack the first few trades that the Red Wings made, starting with Patrick Nemeth going to Colorado for a 2022 fourth round pick.
Yeah, I mean, he was the defenseman that I don't think a lot of people thought was getting moved. I mean, Mark Stahl was the guy really talked about. But Nemeth sending him back to Colorado, which is where he came from prior, and then landing a 2022 fourth round pick is a tidy piece of work from Steve Yzerman. You know, they did have to retain 50% on Nemeth, but he's only signed through the end of the year. So for Detroit, that's not a huge deal. And, you know, for that premium, the price elevates because Colorado needs that $1.5 million paid for. And so Colorado is able to offer up a 2022 fourth round pick. And then, you know, it's kind of nice for Detroit to bet on the variance and go the year out. Now, that being said, Colorado is absolutely not a team that's going to bottom out. That's still going to be in a similar position to where it is this year. But the 2022 draft's a very deep draft, and now Steve Yzerman adds a nice pick to go through and work with for the following year.
Not sure it's four rounds deep.
No, it's not. It's certainly not four rounds deep in the sense that you're making that pick with boatloads of confidence in what you're getting. But I do think there's a lot of talent overall in the draft. And if some guys slip because of, you know, some of the scouting concerns that Eisenman talked about in his press conference, then maybe it is a valuable chip to have.
And it's trade up capital, which is always important. Right. I mean, you look at what it costs to trade up. Let's say you wanted to trade up from the middle of the second round or the late second round with that second Washington pick that you just picked up in the Mantha deal, and you want to trade up back earlier up into the second round, a fourth round pick, you know, could be what helps you get there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of options that you can work with from that fourth round pick.
Absolutely. All right. The next deal was, I think, the one that is in the mold that we've been talking about for what seems like a year now. This is pure cap space trade. The Red Wings are able to serve as an intermediary on David Savard's contract going from Columbus to Tampa Bay. The machinations of it make it look a little funny. It make it look like the Red Wings traded Brian Lashoff for David Savard, and then the Red Wings traded David Savard to the Lightning for a fourth, while Columbus, in the turn of the century, flips Brian Lashoff for a first and a third to the Tampa Bay Lightning. That's not quite what's happening here. What's happening here is in order to make the three-team work, the Red Wings send Lashoff to Columbus so that they can send something to Tampa Bay to get their two picks, while the Red Wings are going to send Savard and retain the cap space. Savard has to come through them in order for them to hold some of his remaining cap hit, and then they send him to Tampa and get their prize direct from Tampa. So that's how that all works. I know people were really confused watching that come together of like, well, why didn't Eisenman just trade Brian Lashoff for a first and a third? That's not really what's happening here. Brian Lashoff actually is staying in Grand Rapids. Tampa Bay just reassigns him to Grand Rapids, so nothing even changes for Brian Lashoff. That's just the machinations of a three-team trade. But really, I think what the narrative out of this was, and I've seen a lot of national writers make this point. Pierre LeBrun had an awesome column about this in The Athletic earlier this week. The Red Wings kind of reset the market on what $250,000 of cap space will get you. And that's a fourth-round pick. And for a team that has a lot of cap space, that's a pretty nice piece of work.
Yeah, I mean, I think to clarify, so it's actually $1 million in cap space, but $250,000 in real cash.
Real salary,
and yes. So, you know, by paying $250,000 in real cash, if you want to view it from that standpoint, that's a heck of a get to for the Wings to be able to walk away with a fourth-round pick in that realm. Now, I think if you view it through the lens of what could $1 million in cap space buy you, then I think you're paying maybe a little bit more than what a fourth-round pick's actually worth, but given that it's only $250,000 in cash, I don't have kind of a huge squabble with that value. And these kinds of deals were the ones that, like you said, Max, we've been talking about for a while. I don't know that we really thought it would be as intricate as it was. And I don't know that that we were expecting to see a handful of these deals happen, including the San Jose deal with Nick Foligno. So ultimately, I think Detroit did a nice job here. Tampa paid an extraordinary premium, though, like we talked about with cap space, to lower the Savard cap hit from the $4+ million all the way down to the $1 million that they're going to be able to use him for. I mean, it ended up costing him a first, a third, and a fourth just to do that. So really goes to show you how shrewd of a move it was for Eisenman to be able to move Mantha in this kind of market.
And then the next move was John Merrill to the Montreal Canadiens for a 2021 fifth-round pick. That's Ottawa's 2021 fifth-round pick, so it will be early. But it's still a fifth round pick. And this was the one that a lot of people weren't so hot on. I think for understandable reasons. I think John Merrill played better than Patrick Nemeth this year. I think John Merrill does have a cheaper contract than Patrick Nemeth this year, even after retention. And so to see Merrill go for a fifth while Nemeth goes for a fourth raises some eyebrows.
Yeah, I mean, I think I texted you this right after the deal happened. I said, I think this is Steve Yzerman's worst transaction as a general manager for the Detroit Red Wings, because John Merrill at $925,000 is a heck of a defenseman. He's a local Michigan guy. He was a guy that, you know, at his age, I think he's 28, right? You bring him back next year. He was very serviceable for the team, and I thought he played well. Good defensive shutdown guy. And to see him moved for Hayden Verbeek and then this fifth round pick from Montreal, although it is Ottawa's pick, which just means it's going to be about 15 picks earlier. But when you're in the fifth round, it's effectively the same thing from a value standpoint. I was a little stunned and actually quite disappointed. And I was getting ready to grade this draft or this trade deadline right after this deal and basically call it a C for Yzerman, because this was arguably the biggest name of the three that moved, but ultimately netted the worst package.
A couple things that I will point to in trying to explain it, not defend it, but just kind of what I could offer up as the potential reasons for this. Number one, I think by retaining salary on Nemeth, even though he still costs more than Merrill, there is a case that, you know, there are only three players you can retain money on. And using one of those spots is in and of itself something that a team that's doing it can use to up their ask, up their price on a deal. Number two is the familiarity between Nemeth and Colorado. He has played for them before. They know exactly what they're getting. There's no mystery. They might even be more motivated to go and get him. Kind of a lesser version of kind of the Kyle Quincy motivation coming back to Detroit a few years ago now. Number three is the contracts. While I think the, obviously less money is better in 2021 and every year at the trade deadline, you still have to remember that at some point the contract is a reflection of what the broader NHL market thinks of players. And if John Merrill signs for $925,000 and Patrick Nemeth signs for $3 million, that is kind of an indication that even though those contracts are signed in different environments, and I want to be very mindful of that, I think it's fair to read that as a reflection that maybe the broader market does view Patrick Nemeth as more valuable than John Merrill. It's not something I would agree with after watching them both this season, but I think they're both good defenders, and I just happen to think Merrill was a better one. As a matter of fact, I looked yesterday. The actual best defensive pair for the Red Wings for this year, by a landslide, was Patrick Nemeth and John Merrill. And actually, I think that's best overall pair for the Red Wings by Evolving Hockey. I think they had an expected goals for percentage north of like 55 on Evolving Hockey for this season, which is pretty remarkable. And so I think they're both good defensemen. But I will admit, when I saw Nemeth go for a fourth, my mind went, okay, so John Merrill's got to get a third then.
Yeah, and I was kind of in the same boat. I mean, number one, I didn't think Merrill was really a guy that was going to get moved. I know, again, the names that were talked about was Mark Stahl, Luke Glendening, Jonathan Bernier. I mean, Merrill wasn't a guy that I had really envisioned moving. And then when you see that return and it was kind of quite underwhelming there, I think that was surprising. But you know what, Max, I think you're right. I mean, it does go to show what the market kind of felt about John Merrill. It's a big reason why the Wings got him for $925,000. It's maybe there's just not a huge perception that matches up with what he's been able to offer up on the ice. And so, you know, in Montreal's case, even though it was a little bit of a redundant deal for Montreal, I don't know that they really needed more defensive defensemen. They still were able to get a pretty solid player out of it for a cheap price.
Yeah. So we'll see what comes of this now for the Red Wings. I mean, I think that they should circle back on John Merrill. And hey, if the market for John Merrill is only a fifth round pick, maybe that means the market for bringing him back, you're still able to get him at a palatable deal. If the Red Wings could bring back John Merrill at 2 years times $2 million, I think that would be a plus free agent signing, personally.
Yeah, and I mean, you end up then, again, hindsight's 20/20, but then you end up viewing that deal as, okay, I got a free fifth round pick for 12 games of John Merrill. And so then that deal certainly gets viewed more favorably if that ends up happening.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we will see. We'll see how that shakes out. I didn't think it was the best value. I think of the four trades, this was the one that I would have considered kind of the old, do you take the best price available or do you set a price and stick to it? On 31 Thoughts, the 31 Thoughts podcast, Elliot Friedman and Jeff Merrick often refer to this as the Brian Burke rule. And I think there is something to be said for it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole challenge here, because I think there's a lot of different philosophies that you can approach at the trade deadline. But in this kind of situation, it is a scenario where either you take the best offer or you get nothing. That's ultimately the bottom line. Now you have to decide thus taking that quote-unquote best offer, if it's an underpay, ultimately influence your future deals and ability to have future transactions that net you appropriate value. I think that's to be determined. I might believe that. And so in that case, maybe you hold out on the deal. But for a guy like John Merrill, who wasn't necessarily a, you're not talking about a Taylor Hall type player. You're talking about a guy who has really been kind of a fourth defenseman for the Red Wings and been very serviceable in that role. It does make sense to sort of say, hey, I'm going to take this versus take nothing.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Here's a good one for you. Okay, minimum 50 minutes played together. Give me your two best Red Wings defense pairings this year by expected goals for percentage.
Two best is going to be, it's going to be Philip Hronek and Danny DeKeyser, and it's going to be John Merrill and Patrick Nemeth.
You're three quarters right.
Ah.
Number one, with 81 minutes time on ice together, which is not a ton, you know, at 5-on-5. And this is score and venue adjusted. Let me unadjust that. Or do we like the score and venue
adjustment? We do like the score and venue adjustment.
All right, we're going to keep the score and venue adjustment. This is all from Evolving Hockey. Number one in 80 minutes together is Philip Hronek and John Merrill. 61% expected goals for percentage. Number two is Patrick Nemeth and John Merrill. I'm sensing a key link here. 60% expected goals for percentage. So you can put John Merrill in two different roles. You can put him with your workhorse, minute-eating defenseman, and play him a lot, and you're gonna get really good minutes out of him. Or you can put him with kind of your true shutdown guy in Nemeth, and they're gonna be a true shutdown pair. I mean, the way that those two pairings did it was different. I mean, they both gave up very little. 1.21 expected goals against per 60 from Merrill and Nemeth, which is an absurdly good rating. But 1.52 goals against per 60 for Merrill and Hronek. That's really, really good. I mean, those are really good numbers. And I can't help but notice John Merrill's on both of those pairings.
Yeah, I mean, he had an outstanding season. And if you scroll even a little bit further down and you look at how he played with Mark Stahl, I mean, he got Mark Stahl to be, you know, again, one of the better pairings for the team this season. I think they were sixth or seventh on.
They're sixth, that's right.
Yeah, so, you know, they're a good, he did a really nice job in his role. And so that's where I think if you're Detroit, you know, maybe you viewed this as, hey, I'll take the price I can get because this is a hometown kid and I think I can bring him back. And the market wasn't super competitive to where I think I can bring him back pretty cheaply.
He also gave one of the five best moments of the season in that mic'd up clip with Victor Hedman that John Merrill did. Did you see that?
That is honestly one of the best moments of the season where what was the exact...
Hedman's like, don't punch me in the face. And Merrill says, I didn't punch you in the face. And Hedman's like, yeah, you did. And Merrill's like, I did? Hedman's like, yeah, you did. He goes, well, then I did. Who gives it? And then it like centers. It's either, you know, it's one of two words, right?
Yeah.
And then Hedman goes, oh, tough guy, huh? And Merrill says, not really, Victor. Which for some reason is just such good comedic delivery.
I mean, it was just... The guy really endeared himself to me. I mean, it's a guy who looked like Joe Dirt playing great defense and had that endearing just personality on the ice that led to stuff like that. And it's just like, you know what? I love it. Give me everything about it. I will eat this up. So, you know, even the Montreal fans are already loving his intro press conference where he's just sitting there in a trucker hat talking to him. It's just like everyone wants to have John Merrill around. So I would absolutely love to see him come back.
Habs fans were so mad at this trade. Like I tweeted out immediately, love this trade from Montreal. What a bit of work to get this guy for a fifth is great job by Marc Bergevin. And I had Habs fans in my mentions like, you don't know what you're talking about. He doesn't solve anything. This sucks. Why couldn't we go get whoever? I was like, okay, you got this guy for a fifth round pick and you're going to love what he brings to your team.
I mean, I think he's a duplicative piece for Montreal, you know, not to litigate Montreal's defense. Yes. And then they waive Victor Mete and then lose him. And then they go out and add two defensemen on deadline day. That's just really, really odd choices to replace Victor Mete. So they were doing a lot of weird stuff. And I don't know that Merrill really solves problems, but they got a nice player for a cheap price.
Yeah. I really strongly think that the Red Wings should look into resetting John Merrill this offseason. It's always easier said than done. I think the hometown kid advantage helps you here, but we'll see.
We certainly shall, but I would love to have him back.
All right. Mantha and Verana, anything that we haven't said about this that we need to? I mean, I think the key point that has come up in the response to what I've written about this is some people think I'm too low on Jacob Verana and I'm not giving this trade enough credit for how good it can be. And I guess I wanted to kind of address that before we get into this, which is that I don't think I am low on Jacob Verana. I think he's a top six NHL forward. We talked about what those distinctions mean. He's produced like someone who can produce as a top line NHL forward. I just also think that Anthony Mantha's ceiling is tremendous. And I think Anthony Mantha's ceiling was kind of on display already in his first game in Washington. And I know the immediate response is going to be, yeah, we saw the ceiling sometimes in Detroit too, and it just wasn't consistent. And that's fair. It might happen that way. But playing next to Nicklas Backstrom, I think is going to bring out a lot in Anthony Mantha. And I could see Anthony Mantha turning in more of that kind of 0.8 to 0.9 points per game level that he did in Detroit in 2019-20 in Washington. And Washington's going to be really, really happy with that. Can Jacob Vrana go from that situation into Detroit and maintain his production? I'm curious about that. You know, I think a lot of people have made the point about his points per 60, which are tremendous. There's no doubt about that. He's a great scorer. I just also wanted to add that at 25... if you're still only getting 15 minutes a night, I think that also merits kind of relevance in the discussion. Like, why, if someone's scoring like that at that level, why are you only giving him 15 minutes a night? Sometimes that's bad coaching, no doubt. And maybe that will prove to be the case, and maybe Detroit will be laughing all the way to the bank about it. But I just felt like it's relevant information to take into account here. And if Jacob Vrana, you know, I expect him to be a top six forward for the Red Wings, and I think at some point, I would like to see him on the top line next to Dylan Larkin with the Red Wings and see what he looks like in that scenario. These are both two guys with great speed. And while I'm not so sure that speed always meshes on one line, I mean, I think Athanasiu McDavid didn't quite go how I thought it would for that reason. I'd like to see it. And I think that Verana is going to score in Detroit. I think he's going to help their offense. I think he's going to help their power play. He's going to go a long way toward replacing the production that they lose in Anthony Mantha. But I think really what it is more a reflection of is I think really highly of Anthony Mantha. And that doesn't mean I think that the Red Wings didn't make a good trade here. I think they did make a good trade here because the draft assets that they got involved in this were very good. And I don't think they need to hit on both picks for this to be a successful trade. But I just do think that they're going to have to make sure that they are getting value in those picks too, because they did give up a really high ceiling young player here. Am I off base with any of that?
I don't think so. And I honestly think, you know, some of the comments about, oh, this is a, you know, the Red Wings fleece the Capitals, or, you know, Anthony Mantha is a sorry player who was never going to be or never amount to anything in Washington. And he was a guy who didn't try. And now you've got Jacob Vrana, who's, you know, top 15 in points per 60. And, you know, one of the top five goal scorers by rates over the last few years, literally slotting in, you know, around Gallagher and Pasternak. That's great. But I do think, and you don't hear me say this often, but there is a context and a nuance that I think is missed, or maybe not necessarily missed as the models attempt to capture it, but they don't honestly fully capture it. And what I mean by that is, you are taking a guy who is playing 14 minutes a night and asking him to greatly alter the role he's playing. He's going to go to now being Detroit's top winger, arguably. He's arguably the most talented winger on the team right now. And he's going to have huge expectations on the power play. He's now going to be seeing his ice time likely get up to 18, 19 minutes a night. And the caliber of defense he's going to see is going to greatly increase. And so the question, the million-dollar question is, can a player that performs in an outstanding fashion in a small role match that production as you escalate their role? More often than not, it doesn't work that way. And we see this time after time. Now, there are rare cases where it does work that way. Jonathan Marchessault, goes from playing a tiny role in Florida to being a 40-goal scorer. William Karlsson, same kind of deal. Not really getting a lot of minutes in Columbus. Boom, he's a 40-goal scorer in Vegas. So, you know, sometimes it does work like that. But I think overarchingly, more often than not, we don't see that play out in that fashion. So for me, I am somewhat tempering my expectations of Jacob Rana. I'm not expecting him to step in and now be a, if you scale up his minutes and match and keep his rate stats the same, you're talking about a 35-goal, 80-point player. I don't think he is that. I think he's going to be a 20 to 25-goal player with 50 points, which, you know, Max, when you laid out the kind of top six and top yep. line forwards, he's right there. That's great. He's on the fringe of being a top line forward. If you set
55, top six all day.
If you set 55 as your threshold for that top line, he's literally on the fringe of that. So he's a heck of a player in his own right, but I don't want people putting that expectation there because I don't think he's going to scale up the same. And on the flip side, Anthony Mantha is going to scale down. He's now going to be given basically Jacob Vrana's role, but a lot more. I think he'll get more minutes. He'll get that power play time. I mean, you looked at Washington's power play. I think they finished 3-for-3, or maybe it was 4-for-4. I can't remember. I mean, that power play is going to be filthy. Mantha's going to get the ice time there. He's going to not have the same attention on his one-timer because, hey, guys, if Alexander Ovechkin's on the other side of the ice, like, you're not going to overshadow onto that Mantha one-timer. And then his line mates were Nicholas Backstrom, one of the best passers of this generation, and TJ Oshie. Like, that is better than any line combination he has ever played on in Detroit. Yeah. And he's getting to do it behind Evgeny Kuznetsov and Alex Ovechkin. So a team can't just key in on him. And what did you see? I mean, you saw Mantha playing with elite skill. I mean, he was absolutely dominant. His line at 5-on-5 in that Washington game, 80.5% 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage. The next best Washington line was at 40%. They were twice as good as any other line there. And so I think what you saw in Detroit is nowhere near what this guy can do when he has some help and protection around him. And I just don't think we talk about that enough. Like, you take a guy like him and you give him some support, you give him some elite teammates, he's going to flourish. You saw the same thing with Thomas Tatar. He leaves Detroit. He gets, you know, he struggles in Vegas, but he hits Montreal where he's playing on their top line. And he's a 60-point player with a 55% expected goals for percentage. And just an absolutely outstanding hockey player.
So here is where I want to take this, which is that Anthony Mantha, if he does reach that next gear, is going to make Washington fans extraordinarily happy, as he should. And I think I speak for both of us when I say we will be personally happy for Anthony Mantha if he reaches that next level in his career. Where I think the trade analysis goes off the rails is in a binary win-loss analysis system. Because I think you can win a trade on value and ultimately have it be unsuccessful. I think you can win a trade on value, have it be, but have it be like not the best thing for your organization. And I think you can win a trade on value and have it be a great thing for your organization. On the flip side, I also think you can lose a trade and have it be the right thing for your organization to do. If the Red Wings, David Pastrnak went with what, the 24th pick in the draft to the Boston Bruins?
About that? Yeah, somewhere in that range. I can't remember, okay. But close to it.
Humor me here. And let's say Jacob Vrana becomes a 30-goal scorer every year for the Red Wings. And he's a cemented part of their young core, leading goal scorer for the next few years and sticks around for when they're a contender. And the Red Wings, by some stroke of under-scouting luck, stumble into a David Pastrnak caliber player. Ooh, at that 25th, 26th pick, whatever it ends up being for them this year. But the Washington Capitals win a Stanley Cup sometime in the next 4 years. Well, anyone who goes back and looks at that trade is going to say, well, yeah, but they gave up a top five player in the league draft pick wise and another first line player. They lost that trade, but they won a Stanley Cup. And conversely, if the Red Wings, even if the Red Wings do not nail this pick and it's not a quote unquote successful trade, it's not a win in hindsight. That doesn't mean that this can't have been the right move for the organization to try to make. Because if Anthony Mantha was not going to reach that next gear that I think he will reach in Washington and Detroit, then moving him while you're able to get another good young player and picks is also a good thing to do, a smart thing to do. And I think that's a really important takeaway in all this, is if you thought that Mantha wasn't going to help you in time, or you thought that he wasn't going to reach his full potential, and that it was going to get harder to get peak value for him as time went on, then I think that's a perfectly good justification too here. So I don't want my message and all this to get lost. I think the Red Wings did well in this trade on value, on timing, all of it. I think that a lot of the success of it in terms of what it does for the rebuild will depend on what they do with the draft picks, but it won't change my opinion that they made a good trade on April 12th, 2021, and that the process was smart. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly where I'm at. I think no matter what happens with Anthony Mantha, this is a win for Detroit. You did exactly what you needed to do with a player that you viewed to maybe be outside of your rebuilding window. So you went out, you got enough assets in the picks, and then you went out and effectively got a replacement player for him so that you don't really and truly bottom out. Now, I think Detroit has the potential, as we mentioned in the last episode, to really take this deal to another level if they're able to then take Jacob Vrana and turn him into another return along those lines or even something close to that. Now you're really talking about a deal that can reshape the franchise moving forward.
I agree. And I don't think they're going to, I should clarify, I don't think they're going to get David Pastrnak or a David Pastrnak equivalent, because that's like a once in a decade situation that a player of that caliber falls into that range of picks. But you can get good players there. You can get a Travis Konecny in that range, right? You'll be thrilled if you got Travis Konecny with this pick, right?
Yeah. I mean, you absolutely would be. Because again, remember, these picks towards the end of the first round, there's no guarantee that they're even NHL players.
Yeah.
So getting a guy like Travis Konecny there, you should be over the moon.
I think if you can get a, you know, like I would say the is Joe Valeno kind of a par value pick or a plus value pick for 30th overall?
I think he's probably a par value pick, right? I mean, if you think about where he was drafted at 30th overall, the number of years so far we've waited to see him hit and kind of where we're projecting him to land as maybe a third line center, I think that's maybe par for the course or about average for the pick.
So expect a Joe Valeno type, a middle six player in that spot. And if you do better than that, be thrilled. And if you do worse, understand that was a real risk the whole time. I mean, this is a weird year for scouting. And every draft is already hard enough as it is, even without that. So I don't think that changes the process of the decision of making this move. You trust your scouts, you believe that you know how to find talent, and you give yourself the chance to go get it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so that's kind of, I guess, kind of my rant on this. I felt bad because I felt like my point was not getting across. I felt like people were thinking I was down on Vrana, who I really think is a legit top six forward. Probably should play on Detroit's top line at some point here, and I think is deserving of that. I just think that a lot of the trade is independent of that, although I think Vrana could make this trade by himself. If Vrana's as good as Mantha, this is a home run.
Yeah, I mean, if Vrana's as good as Mantha and you're able to either decide, you know, you want to keep Jacob Vrana as a part of this core, or he's as good as Mantha, you extend him to a good team-friendly deal, and then you flip him for another Mantha return, right, and now you're viewing the Mantha return as two first-round picks and two second-round picks, you're like, okay, this is an absolute home run.
And I think it can still be a success even if he's not. Let's say he's Athanasiou good. Like good, I think that's kind of what you were saying, right? Like good 20 to 25, 45 to 55 point guy. That's a little better than Athanasiou.
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe a little bit better than Andreas Athanasiou is what you're what I would set as your expectation for Jacob Vrana in Detroit.
And if he's that and you get a prospect of, you know, Valeno caliber, or even a little more than that, let's say you get a Valeno and a Mastro Simoni or a Valeno and a Johansson, you're still really pumped about that trade, I think, big picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what you're hoping for.
So that's how I view this trade. But since you already teased it, let's just go right into that. How confident are we that Jacob Vrana plays 94 games with the Detroit Red Wings?
I'm not actually that confident, because I think if you are Steve Yzerman and you traded Anthony Mantha because, you know, in your opinion, he is Maybe his age kind of puts him outside of the rebuild window. We don't know that, to be clear. We don't. This is all speculation by Elliott Friedman, I should say, that he kind of speculated something along those lines in 31 Thoughts, and it sort of makes sense.
It does make sense.
You know, so if that's the case, Jacob Vrana is 18 months younger than Anthony Mantha. He's just turned 25 in February. So you would kind of look at this and say, does he fit in the long-term rebuild if you're dealing a guy like Mantha who's going to be 27 in September? Or are the Red Wings effectively looking to set him up to be another guy that they can flip for more draft capital, another prospect, something along those lines? I think that's kind of the smart move if you're Detroit, is that Mantha deal to me really signaled a pivot to the future core, quote-unquote, being Philip Zadina, Mo Sider, Lucas Raymond. And pivoting by flipping Vrana for more picks allows you to continue to build and add to that core. So I think that's maybe the smart move here if you are Steve Yzerman.
How many of the current young forwards in the 24 to 26 range do you need to keep realistically?
I think realistically, you don't have to keep any of them, but I don't think you have to keep any of them because you can go out and bring in that veteran presence. And again, I think that Mantha deal sort of signals that the Wings are 4 to 5 years away. I think that's what the deal signals, or at least what Yzerman maybe thinks is that they are that far away for him to not, again, this is all speculation, but for him to not view Mantha to be a part of that puzzle. And so if you are saying 4 to 5 years away, then Philip Zadina is 25 by the time that happens. And so do I need the guys that are going to be anywhere from 29 to 31 at that point in time to be there? I don't know that you have to. I think you can get by without it. But I do think obviously Dylan Larkin is certainly a part of the long-term future for Detroit.
I do too.
But I think realistically speaking, you don't have to keep him.
So let me go back to something that Bobby Ryan told me a couple weeks ago about Dylan Larkin. I was able to talk with Bobby about kind of reflecting on his season. Actually, ironically, like 2 days before it was announced that he was out for the season, which I don't know that even he knew at that time. But what he told me about Larkin is he says he's always the hardest working guy. I can't remember a day where I thought he was off and he's not working. Like he just comes to work, he puts his gear on and he goes about his business. And for a guy, he referenced Philip Zadina, Z sees that every single day and that becomes infectious. I think there's an element of veteran leadership that can bring that. I don't think it captures the same way as when it is your best player and a guy who's only really a couple of years older than you. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think totally. I mean, you see that across a number of different sports when, you know, guys talk about the best player. I mean, hell, in Detroit, we talked about for years, Nick Lidstrom set the standard. Then Henrik Zetterberg set the standard of what work ethic was going to be like. And you can, Max, you can use this exact argument on me. What do you think Dylan Larkin saw, right? He watched Henrik Zetterberg right. And that kind of work ethic. And now potentially he's the standard bearer for those guys moving forward.
And it's your best player. Like it's not just one of the veteran right. guys, bottom six guys who you might be able to talk yourself into saying, well, that's how that guy's in the league is he does it that way. And I do it my way. It's no, if Dylan Larkin, the best player on the team can do it this way, why would I not do it this way?
Exactly. And so that's, I think the argument you make to keeping a guy like Larkin around. You know, I think realistically speaking, when I'm talking about this from a pure objective standpoint, I don't really know how to quantify how much of an impact that makes relative to a lot of the other things that go into what we see ultimately on the ice. And so for me, with that level of uncertainty, I am kind of hesitant to say, yes, I have to have that. But it absolutely makes sense, especially when you look at the lineage of what we've seen in Detroit with Lidstrom watching Yzerman, you know, and then you have Zetterberg watching Lidstrom, and then you have, you know, now Larkin watching Zetterberg. It's kind of that lineage has been there for 30, 40 years now.
Yeah, and a point that I think it was, you listened to this week's 31 Thoughts podcast, right?
Yeah.
I think, was it Merrick that made the point of like, you it's also a guy who can relate to the younger players because he is still closer to their age.
Right. That's a key, I think, that separates maybe, you know, some of the other scenarios is Larkin is still 25.
24.
24, that's right.
He'll turn 25 soon, though.
Let me not age him here.
Yeah, that's right. So I think it's an important conversation, but the reason I ask you how many should stay is not just about Dylan Larkin. It's about Tyler Bertuzzi. It's about Jacob Vrana. It's about Robbie Fabbri. Right now, we're talking about 75% of the Red Wings' top six wingers when I say that, which is really their four best wingers as I say that. And so I don't know what this offseason is going to look like. If I thought 4 days ago that the Mantha trade was surprising, I'm kind of starting to say maybe I should reset what surprises me.
Yeah, I think so, because I think if you're a Red Wings fan, I would buckle up and maybe prepare for some fireworks this offseason.
We'll certainly see. I mean, Bertuzzi, if I am an opposing team, now we got to see what's up with his health, because he's missed a lot of time, and that is a huge conversation here. If I am an NHL GM who either has a kind of fringy playoff team or a true contender, I can look at Bertuzzi and I can see a guy who will raise my level in the playoffs. And if I'm a fringy playoff team that needs to get tougher to play against without having to bring in somebody one dimensional to fill that role, Tyler Bertuzzi is one of the very first names on my list. And if I'm a contender that has the cap room to accommodate someone like Tyler Bertuzzi, he's very, very high on my list, because his game will play up in the postseason. We've been saying it for years. He's done it at every single level in the postseason. Just hasn't had the chance to do it yet in Detroit. Selfishly, as a hockey observer, I want to see Tyler Bertuzzi in the playoffs.
I would love to. I think he's built exactly for it. I would love to see that happen in Detroit, but I think realistically it's quite far away at this point.
We'll see what happens. I mean, I am well aware that I have been the person for 2 years now who will go on this podcast and tell everybody to settle down about trading Mantha and Bertuzzi. And now that they traded Mantha, I kind of feel like I have to shut up with that line of that narrative that I've been sticking to, I guess.
I mean, it's sort of funny. I bet if we went back and tracked through our history, the first time I think we brought up Mantha being dealt was actually last season.
And I probably said, oh my God.
I can't quite remember the eye roll, but it might have been there.
My line of thinking has basically, and I think this encapsulates the conversation we're having, is that if you're going to trade one of them, who aren't you trading? And I think I meant that to make a different point than the one that is now coming to fruition here.
Which is, you should who trade you them trading? All.
I wouldn't trade Larkin unless somebody came to me with something that was just absolutely ridiculous, and that was already true. That's the eternal rule. I would not trade Dylan Larkin.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem holding that and just saying, you know what, I'm not going to trade Dylan Larkin. He is going to be a part of this team. There's nothing wrong with that. I think at the end of the day, you have to do your due diligence. You field all the offers. If someone comes up to you and says, hey, I'm going to hand you four first-round picks for Dylan Larkin, then, okay, you have to talk about it. But realistically, someone's got to blow your socks off with a deal like that to make that happen.
I don't know if people will believe me when I say this, because I have written my fair share of it in the last few years I've been on the beat, but trade speculation is my literal least favorite part of, second least favorite part of this job. First least favorite is transcribing interviews.
Yeah, that's fair. And that's exactly why I built a trade machine, so we can just talk about trade speculation.
Yeah, you did it too, just to drive me crazy.
Exactly.
May not be done with it for a while. We'll see what happens. All right, moving on. Did you have something else to say?
No, I was saying we're not done, because if you look at our mailbag here, right, what were a majority of the questions? We basically tackled the questions from some of y'all. I think questions that I had noted was from Big Head 365 about dealing Bertuzzi. I think John Keslarich said a similar question. Corey Hames talks about flipping Jacob Vrana. You got Adam Dubois talks about, is it anyone but Larkin or everyone? So these were the questions. These are what everyone wanted to hear from us. And
all right, so that makes me feel better. I'm just going to pretend like I knew that those were everybody's questions and that I was just answering questions and not following the thing.
Yeah, and so I'm making sure everyone gets their shout out. You know, we also had Burr 871. Does Dylan Larkin get traded this summer or next? And so, Max, your answer is he doesn't get traded in either of those summers. So
that'd be my answer.
All right.
Here's what I want to know to you. What do you okay, so people talk about flipping Vrana. To me, once a guy gets traded once, does it lower his trade value to get traded again?
You know, I think this is a fascinating question, one I have never looked into. My intuition is no. However, you know, as I'm thinking about this out loud and on the spot, I sort of do think I can recall diminishing returns in guys that are dealt.
Well, Taylor Hall.
A handful. I mean, well, Taylor Hall is a very different story because of this no move clause that seems like maybe he was forcing his way to Boston, in which case Boston held all the cards. So I'm not going to really read into the return there. But I mean, there are a handful of situations where you see different guys get flipped. And, you know, Max, I think you're right. I don't know how often the second flipping or even the third ever exceeds the first.
The reason I ask it is because I put myself in the shoes of a general manager who would be acquiring a player who I know was traded within the last year. And in hockey, you try to gather as much information as you can, I'm sure. But you also have to know that as in anything else in life, you're dealing with a limited amount of information. And if you're the team acquiring, you are realizing that the other team knows more about the player that they would potentially trade you than you do. And if I'm saying, all right, one team traded him and added a first round pick in the deal of that trade. Well, now this other team that just got him wants to trade him within a year and a half to me. What am I missing here?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge. I think if you are a general manager though, and you see, you know, again, I think we're going to assume that Jacob Vrana goes out, plays exactly like Jacob Vrana and doesn't diminish his value in any way there. Part of me wants to say that nothing changes, because if you still see the same on-ice product, why would that alter? Why would the fact that he was dealt previously, particularly in a scenario like this, where he is not the centerpiece of the deal, he is actually a throw-in to the Anthony Mantha deal. I don't know that would let that weigh on me, but maybe I'm thinking about this very different than how an NHL GM would think about it.
You could be right. You could very well be right. I just, it's a curiosity that I always have. And my inclination is that as we're talking about Jacob Vrana as a top six first line forward, that has value unquestionably. I just wonder if the move itself affects that in any way.
Yeah, I think I'll dig into this a little bit more. Maybe I'll have a better answer for us next time.
All right, that sounds good. All right, we'll go back into the rest of the mailbag here and say on a scale, this is from Geo Fitz. On a scale from 1 to Braden Point, where do you think the Mantha trade ranks among Yzerman's best all-time trades as a GM? People really like this deal.
I mean, this is but think about it, right? This is a heck of a scaled like deal that he's made. And if you think about, you know, the Drouin trade that he makes for Sergachev. You know, you think about the McDonough deal. You think about, you know, Marty St. Louis' deal. This is a big, big swing. I think it's too early to truly tell how this deal stacks up, because I think historical narrative certainly paints how the Sergachev-Drouin deal looked. I think at the time, a lot of people were very high on Jonathan Drouin and didn't think he would bottom out the way he did. And people hadn't really seen a ton of Mikhail Sergachev to know. So I think history has certainly landed in the favor there. But if I'm kind of prognosticating where history is going to land, I think this deal still comes in well behind that Drouin Sergachev deal.
I think there's a few that were just absolute coups that Yzerman had. I mean, the Bishop trade that he traded away, Corey Conacher.
Right, Corey Conacher for Ben Bishop.
Who becomes like a Vezina finalist. And then, oh, by the way, if you want to go trade tree on this, he trades Bishop for Eric Chernak, who's a top 4D on a cup team.
Just
he's
insane.
Really good at this job. He's really good at it.
So look at that. There's the answer to your previous question. Ben Bishop's traded. He only gets Corey Conacher, and then the second time around, he gets Eric Chernak. So,
all right, but Conacher, there you go. At the time of that trade, Conacher might have been a more desirable asset than Chernak was at the time of his.
That is true. That is very true.
Hockey's weird, man. Stuff happens and you think it's going to go one way and it goes completely the other all the time.
Yeah, I mean, literally nothing was happening on deadline day and then you get that Mantha deal out of nowhere. So it's just stuff happens. You just got to be ready for it.
You have to admit it was eerily quiet. Like I didn't know this was happening. I don't want to portray that I had that I was aware of this and I was holding out on it or anything like that. I didn't know until Kevin Weeks tweeted it. And then, you know, really Pierre confirmed it a few minutes later, LeBrun, but it was eerily quiet around the Red Wings all day. I just had this feeling that, I couldn't believe that nothing had happened because of how quiet it had been.
Yeah. I mean, I was, again, if you want to know where my state of mind was, I was about to take a nap. I was literally plugging my phone in, setting the alarm for my nap. And then my phone starts pinging. And it's all these people tagging me in the Kevin Weeks tweet. And so I go and look and I was like, oh no, this didn't actually happen, did it? And then the follow-up tweet comes and includes first and second round pick.
Well, and Kevin Weeks was almost an NHL GM a few months ago, right?
Right.
So if Kevin Weeks says it, it's like, oh, he knows some stuff.
But then I was initially skeptical because you didn't hear it from Pierre, you didn't hear it from Elliot Friedman, you didn't hear it from Drager.
You basically had a pseudo rival GM tweeted out.
Right. It was basically just Kevin Weeks for a little while. And then there's David Pagnotta who comes through. And I was like, okay, I don't actually know if this is happening, but now I can't take a nap and this better actually happen or I've wasted my opportunity for a nap. And then the deal happened, and I think I sat there for 45 minutes with my mouth open, going, I don't know what is actually happening right now.
Madness. All right, here's a few on what to do with the extra draft pick. Connor says, does the extra first-round pick mean they should be going after Wallstedt? And do you think this gives him a better shot at a top pick in 2022 versus keeping Mantha?
Yeah. This is so I guess to tackle the first part, does this mean they're going after Wallstedt? I certainly hope not. You know, I think I've been over this a number of times. I am actually going to write an article that includes some information about this, so people can hang on. I will lay it out another way, but I think their first pick has to be a top level player. Whether they're deciding between one of the defensemen, you know, for me that'd be Owen Power or Brant Clark, or if they're deciding between one of the forwards, I think, you know, Matty Beniers, Dylan Guenther, those are the guys for me towards the top of the draft. That I would focus on. So I wouldn't take Wallstedt there, and he's not going to survive to the Capitals pick. Now, as far as do you think that this gives him a better shot at a top pick in 2022? I think a lot of it depends on what they do with Bertuzzi and Vrana. You know, obviously keeping Anthony Mantha prevents them from totally bottoming out. And next year you're going to see Mo Sider join the team. You may see some of the other guys like Joe Valeno. You may see you know, a Berggren appearance, although unlikely, and you may see a Raymond appearance, although unlikely. But I think it sort of depends on if Bertuzzi's back for the whole season and Vrana stays. If both those guys are gone, then I think it absolutely gives him a better shot at a 2022 pick.
Yeah, I can buy that argument. I think that I don't think I would go after Wallstedt, but if he fell to me at that spot, I think I'm comfortable with it. I don't think I would move up for it. Has Wallstedt, his numbers have dipped, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly slowed down. He wasn't going to keep those numbers up the entire way in the SHL. That was just a ridiculous start. And even we saw the same thing happen with Askarov last year. I think he got real hot at the beginning. He slowed a little bit down and has come back to earth. I think if you look at, you know, Wallstedt, he's 2.223 goals against average, 908 save percentage. 12-10 record, 2 shutouts. You know, he did fine, but he definitely fell back to earth from where he was at the beginning. And again, to me, it's just that inconsistency in prognosticating the goaltender that makes me very wary about spending a high draft pick when I have to hit on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. Okay. Here's one from Joe D. Would you have preferred if one of those picks were taken out for Connor McMichael? Especially if the pick will be around the 20s and he's excelling from his pick position. I think this one's an obvious yes, but Montreal doesn't do that.
You mean Washington doesn't do that, right? Connor McMichael, I don't think, was going to ever be in that deal. And if you're including Connor McMichael, I think both those picks are coming out. And so McMichael's great. He still would technically fit the timeline because he's a 19 draft pick.
Yes.
So you know, he would still be within that window that the Wings seem to be moving towards. I'd certainly like it. I know more about him. I have more information. He's more quickly going to be with the team. But at the same time, I'm very much okay with a 2021 first and a 2022 second from that deal. So I think the answer is yes, but I don't think it would have happened.
I can't speak universally. I have not watched Connor McMichael play. But just to give people a sense, like, Corey Pratman had Connor McMichael ranked as the number 22 overall under 23 hockey player. Like, that includes guys in the NHL. He was above Lucas Raymond in Corey's most recent ranking in January. So that's the kind of caliber of prospect McMichael was. Like, I don't even know. Does Montreal do McMichael for Mantha straight up? They probably do.
Probably do, because it fits their window better.
But like,
but yeah,
he's like, it, assuming that that, like, you know, that that level of value, I think McMichael's not your ordinary late 20s pick. If you get a McMichael, you're absolutely thrilled in that range.
Yeah, I mean, he fell, you know, for reasons in that first year, and then he came back with a 2 point per game season the following year. So, you know, he's a heck of a hockey player.
A ridiculous talent. Okay. All things Detroit. Could Raymond and Johansson potentially play in GR this season? Might be tight with visa issues and quarantine, but I'm not sure if they could even play at all this season in GR. So, real quick, both were eliminated Wednesday from the SHL playoffs.
Yeah, so I don't think Raymond's healthy yet for you to see him. Johansson, I think...
Raymond also hasn't signed.
Right, right. Raymond also has to sign first. So maybe, but I think it's doubtful.
And I think, I don't know how the World Championships come into play here. If they can, if they... Johansson's on loan, so I believe he could come back, but I don't know the rules on this. Maybe somebody out there who does could chime in on Twitter. I don't know that Johansson would be picked for the World Championship team, but I do believe he got picked for their national team for one of the late season tournaments. I think that's relevant. That would apply to Bergeron too. Bergeron is also unsigned. But I would think, you know, I asked Steve Yzerman about this the other day, and he pretty much said what the question asker said about quarantine and visa issues. But this does give them, I mean, they've got 3 weeks now. Does the AHL season end right about the same time as the NHL?
I want to say it goes a little bit later, because so it started up a little bit later.
So, yeah. So maybe a month. And if they could get those guys over here and do their week quarantine, that could give them a couple weeks to come over. But I don't think they're going to do it just for a couple games or anything like that. But if they could get, you know, some sustained time, it could make some sense. They'll talk about it. But Yzerman basically didn't have any specifics on this when I asked him on Monday.
Yeah, I think it'll be unlikely.
Yeah. All Things Detroit also asks, anyone heard anything regarding development camp, prospect tournaments, and or preseason? I know it's early for these things. I'm curious if they'll happen. I assume preseason will happen, but the other two won't. I don't have the answer to it, but I will try to get it and let you know as I hear. But I imagine the world's going to change a whole lot in the next 4 or 5 months, and so might be a little early to have that answer.
Yeah.
Any word on Keith Petrozelli? That's from D. Hatman. No, I have not heard any update on Keith Petrozelli, and I'm curious about it. I know I probably should have tried to squeeze it in to that press conference. I just had already asked 4 questions, and there was a lot of people on that call, and I didn't want to bogart too much of it, but I will poke around and see if I can get an update on that. And then the last one, I appreciated this question from John Evans, who asked about going to Montreal. I went to Montreal in summer 2019 to work on a story about Anthony Mantha and his trainer, Matt Latour, who passed away. And he said, what was it like to travel with Mantha to Montreal? Did they let you rent a car? I think he probably is recently finding out that I'm 25, which I was not at that time. I didn't travel to Montreal with Mantha. I just traveled to Montreal and met up with Mantha for that story. The reason that I wanted to answer this one on air is because I felt like it was a good opportunity for me to just say how much I appreciated covering Anthony Mantha over the years. He was one of the most accessible, easy guys to talk to in that locker room. Very honest, very available. That story that we did in 2019, I was not sure. I would not have faulted him in any way if he didn't want to do a story about that. He didn't, you know, he basically gave me 2 days into his life at that time, at a very sensitive, hard moment in his life. And I will forever appreciate him being willing to open up and let me come up to Montreal and do that story. He is a very nice guy. He, you know, I didn't travel with him, like the question said, but he was very nice picking me up from the subway station. And so I and he also wouldn't let me take an Uber back to my hotel one night. He insisted on driving me himself. He's a really good guy. And I will forever have a lot of respect for Anthony and appreciate Anthony as just being a great guy to cover. So I wanted to close on that. And I appreciate John for asking that question, because I certainly am glad to speak to that. So,
yeah, he's a heck of a hockey player, heck of a human.
Yep, absolutely. All right, I think that will do it for us for today then. Great questions today. You guys nailed this mailbag and gave us a ton to cover for the show. So keep that up. Good on you all. And we'll be back at you on Monday. Thanks.